quite honestly, folks don't want to hear that we're engaged in more process. They want to know that we've got resources on the ground.
Alaska's senators press for support for combating violence in Alaska Native communities. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a federal grand jury indictment against mining executives for discharging into the Salmon River in southwest Alaska.
We could tell from still being miles, 2 miles away from the river, that something wasn't right.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The trauma American Indian and Alaska Native children experience due to the high levels of violence in their communities was the subject of a hearing today in the U.S. Senate Indian Affairs Committee. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, both Alaska senators pressed for solutions in law and federal dollars.
Vernay Berner, president of the Alaska Native Health Board, asked senators for just two things. One was an increase in funding for behavioral health. The other was to end Alaska's exclusion from the Violence Against Women Act so that Alaska tribes can issue restraining orders to combat domestic violence. Berner spoke after others had already recited some of the terrible statistics, including that 75% of Alaska Natives have endured adverse events in their childhoods, such as abuse or violence.
I offer to you a face to go with those numbers. I was sexually abused from the time I was 9 until 14. I lived in fear and silence those years, but when the man who abused me told me that my sister, who turned 9, was ready, I went to the police.
The hearing came a day after a task force report highlighted the damage violence inflicts on the children of Native Americans. Senator Mark Begich emphasized his efforts to repeal Alaska's exclusion from the Violence Against Women Act.
It just seems fair that we would want to fix it for all First People of this country, not just the lower 48.
A bill he sponsored called the Alaska Safe Families and Villages Act was held up by Republicans. Senator Lisa Murkowski says her colleagues are waiting for a Justice Department review. But Begich, whose days as a senator are running out, has now presented the Senate with a stripped-down version of the bill that he hopes will attract less dissent. At the hearing, Murkowski said Alaska tribes don't have secure access to federal money for courts or law enforcement. She said she'd try to rectify that through her position on the Interior Appropriations Subcommittee. Murkowski pressed Robert Listenby, a Justice Department administrator, to consider more reliable formula funding for Alaska tribal justice programs.
Can you at least tell us that you're going to look at it? We've got to make some headway on this.
Well, Senator, what we know is that we agree with the advisory committee.
His 42nd answer wasn't what Murkowski wanted to hear.
You know, quite honestly, folks don't want to hear that we're engaged in more process. They want to know that we've got resources on the ground. They know that tribal courts are funded in the lower 48. They know that they're not funded in Alaska. That doesn't make sense to them. It doesn't make sense to me.
Murkowski then turned to Yvette Rubidoux, acting director of the Indian Health Service. The senator says she's done politely requesting funds to sustain village clinics because the clinics provide behavioral health services and health care that victims of violence need.
You have got to help us with these village-built clinics. You have got to help us. Yes?
Well, yes, we do want to help, and that's why we've been working in with.
But
the
we haven't seen that through the budgets put forth by this administration.
The hearing did have a bright spot. Rick Vandenpoel of the National Native Children's Trauma Center says childhood trauma is treatable and that as few as 10 group sessions have proven effective. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
XS Platinum and five of its employees and corporate officers have been indicted by a federal grand jury for alleged illegal discharges of mine wastewater at the Platinum Creek Mine in southwest Alaska and for making false statements to authorities. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
First Assistant U.S. Attorney Kevin Feldes says XS Platinum had told federal regulators they would be using a closed-loop system at the Platinum Creek Mine.
That means any water that they used in their mining operations were going to be kept in the mine itself, and they weren't going to be discharged out to the river. The allegations are that, in truth, in fact, they were discharging out to the Salmon River, and that those discharges were in violation of federal law.
The indictment says the discharges into the Salmon River happened between 2010 and 2011. The Salmon River hosts all five species of salmon and drains into Kuskokwim Bay. Lou Adams is the tribal administrator in Platinum. She says residents get most of their fish from the area.
We go fishing for salmon, and people were fishing down there during that time. How is it going to affect the people that ate the fish that were swimming in that water?
Adams says residents could see changes to the normally clear water.
There was a lot of sediments in the creek. It turned milky white, like something was stirring it up.
It looked like chocolate milk, caramel-colored milk. We could tell from still being two miles away from the river that something wasn't right.
Mark Lisick is a fisheries biologist for the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. He was flying a fish survey in August of 2011, but couldn't see any fish. After notifying other government regulators to the potential violations, refuge staff collected water and fish samples. Lori Verbrigge, a contaminants biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, found seven metals in the water that posed a potential threat to aquatic life. Two that stuck out were aluminum and copper.
We don't really know whether those impacts have happened to fish in that system because I'm not sure if there's been any follow-up. We don't really know how long those levels were elevated or how far downstream the levels were elevated. But we do know right there in the mine vicinity that they were quite elevated.
In juvenile salmon, she found elevated levels of aluminum, iron, and manganese. Again, she's not sure the exact effects, but says the elements can have toxic effects for the fish. The indictment charges that the company far exceeded the permit limitations for turbidity at measurements hundreds of times the allowed amounts. It says the company used wastewater ponds that leaked into the Salmon River and dug a ditch to direct wastewater into nearby Squirrel Creek. The company never bought a clarifier used to recycle water, despite telling regulators it would do so. Prosecutors say the company produced 3,800 troy ounces of platinum metals in violation of the permits, which they sold for about $3.2 million. The mine has been in operation on and off for more than 70 years. It was a critical resource during World War II. XS Platinum operated the mine between 2008 and 2012. The charges against the company and five employees are felony offenses. Feldes says the defendants will be given notice of the charges and arraignment will be scheduled in federal court. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission, or APOC, held a hearing today involving Charlene Egbe, better known as Charlo Green. The commission heard testimony that will help them decide to pursue a subpoena for information on whether Egbe violated state rules by using money collected by her business, Alaska Cannabis Club, to support Proposition 2 in this year's election. Paul Dauphiné, APOC's executive director, says the case may hinge on whether Egbe acted as an individual or on behalf of a business group.
There's differences in the definitions. There's nuances of when one thing happens and one thing doesn't. And for us, group is kind of an all-encompassing term. An individual, under the definition, is a natural human being. A person can be a corporate entity.
Those definitions are drawn from the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision. Egbe was present but didn't speak during the hearing. However, she was represented in testimony by Don Hart, who described himself as a friend of Egbe's and says she never spent any of the Cannabis Club's money on Prop 2. He says she pursued broader campaigns for legal access to marijuana and voter enrollment.
Everything she did in support of Prop 2 herself was individual support. But her whole purpose of providing any kind of support at all was providing support for people to get them to register to vote.
The total amount of money in question is about $11,000. The commission will release its decision on whether or not to proceed within the next 10 days. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska's weatherization program focuses on another problem, proper ventilation.
Water, moisture from your breath, from your cooking, from your aquariums, from your plants can cause negative effects on your home.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Senator Mark Begich finally conceded that he lost the election this week, but for now, until January 3rd, he's still a U.S. Senator, and he's back in Washington.
Very proud of the folks that worked on my campaign, and unbelievable honor to serve Alaska and be able to do the work that I've done the last 6 years, but we are here today, and business has to go on.
Begich's Alaska priorities for the lame duck session include passing the Coast Guard bill, which calls for expanded activities in the Arctic, and a land trade at Port Clarence aimed at building a deep-water Arctic port. National Journal and other publications have speculated he's plotting to run against Alaska Congressman Don Young in the future, or maybe against Senator Lisa Murkowski. Begich isn't saying.
We'll let them speculate, and for now I'm just going to reevaluate and see what I want to do, but also I know I'm going to continue to contribute back to the community of Alaska in many ways that I've done in and out of politics. I'll continue to do that.
Begich says he's not ruling out a return to the Capitol someday. Japanese company Resources Energy Incorporated has plans to beat other larger companies to the punch when it comes to shipping LNG from Alaska to Japan. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the company is courting Matsu's Port McKenzie as a site for its gas plant project.
Natural gas-hungry Japan is eyeing the short distance between Alaska and Japan as one reason to build an LNG processing plant here. Resources Energy Alaska CEO Mary Ann Pease says the plan for a mid-sized plant is small compared with other projects. If constructed, the plant could produce 1 million tons of LNG a year for shipment overseas. So far, Nikiski's LNG plant is the only one in Alaska.
A 1 million ton facility is about the same size as the ConocoPhillips plant, and you expand eventually when North Slope gas becomes available.
Pease, who just returned from an LNG conference in Japan, says that country's need for cheap energy after the Fukushima disaster creates an opportunity for Alaska producers.
Timing is so very critical. There are so many projects worldwide that are on the horizon that making sure that that relationship and focus on Alaska is there early on is critical.
She says the independent oil and gas producers in Alaska can benefit from the project. Resources Energy won't wait for North Slope gas. Pease says the company is eyeing Cook Inlet for supply, although no contracts are in place yet with those producers.
The 1 million ton facility requires about 160 million cubic feet a day of gas, and that would come from the Cook Inlet. We've done a reservoir analysis and a very robust model that shows that after all the in-state demand has been met, there's still surplus gas of about 160 million cubic feet a day for the next 20 to 30 years for export.
Resources Energy is working with the Houston, Texas firm KBR on a technical and feasibility study for the project. Pease says that the cost of the entire project could be between $1 and $2 billion. Port McKenzie would be used as a staging area to bring in materials, although Resources Energy would have to build its own dock, since federal law does not allow LNG to be shipped from the existing dock. The proposed plant would be constructed on a mix of private and leased property. Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough Manager John Moosey says negotiations are underway.
We think Port McKenzie would be a perfect spot for them. We're early in the discussions. We have been providing information to them so they can do their due diligence and make a correct decision. But we've been working for well over a dozen years for these type of opportunities, and the REI project fits right into our wheelhouse.
The LNG plan has to be approved by the Federal Department of Energy and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission before it can move ahead. Although that process is lengthy, Pease says she's confident that the plant can be operable by 2020. Funding would be handled by Resources Energy's parent company in Japan.
Japanese money will definitely be the bulk of the ownership. They will have the majority share of this project, and they will utilize Japan bank financing. And that is very low-cost financing.
Although the Resources Energy project is focused on export, Pease says the company would be quite comfortable in providing LNG at the gate for Alaska utilities which want it. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Representatives from across Southeast Alaska and the country are meeting in Sitka this week to hash out timber issues on the Tongass. It's the fourth meeting of the Tongass Advisory Committee, which is advising the U.S. Forest Service on how to switch its focus from old-growth logging to harvesting smaller, younger trees. In 2010, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture announced the Tongass transition to phase out old-growth timber sales in the nation's largest national forest. The goal was to build a timber industry focused on second-growth trees and provide an economic boost for the region. But that transition has not moved as fast as some hoped. The advisory committee was created this year to help move the transition forward. And that's no easy task, says Andrew Toms, a committee member and the executive director of the Sitka Conservation Society.
The major sticking points are that the Forest Service and I think most people in Southeast Alaska want to see some sort of a timber industry that uses the wood resources that we have here and the timber resources that we have in the Tongass, but figuring out how to do that in a way that creates a sustainable long-term yield and is economical without causing environmental damage is really a difficult mixture to figure out how it all comes together.
There are 15 committee members, including representatives from the timber industry, commercial fishing, tribal groups, and local governments, as well as conservationists like Tomes. They are being asked to reconcile the needs of those factions into a set of recommendations for the Tongass Land Management Plan. That's the document that governs who can do what and where on the Tongass.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
The state's weatherization program began in 1978 during the energy crisis and continues to help families deal with ever-rising energy costs. Weatherizing means making heating systems more efficient and plugging up the holes in a home to keep the heat inside. But KSKA's Ann Hillman found out it's not just about economics, it's also about safety.
59-year-old Bonita Lozano wants to keep her 37-year-old mobile home warm. So last summer, she applied for Anchorage's weatherization program through RuralCap. They replaced her aging furnace and sealed the areas around her windows, doors, and other places that could leak. And though Lozano was happy, she wanted to make sure the house was airtight. She taped extra strips of foam to the bottom of her doors to seal the tiniest gap.
You see, they have a gap in here.
Oh, down at the bottom, yeah.
Yeah, you see, did you see this? If this is just like the car wiper,
yeah,
it's gonna be work because when you close it, it's gonna, you see, close.
Go back in place, yeah.
Yes.
Lozano's trailer was one of the 375 low-income homes RuralCap weatherized in Anchorage this year. That includes houses, trailers, and even apartments. The program focuses on seniors, disabled people, and families. Program manager John Simpson says they spend on average $6,000 to $8,000 per unit to make improvements. The average project reduces energy usage by 20 to 30%. One of the most common upgrades is air sealing.
You had a loose window, door, attic hatch, etc. You have your good warm air going, escaping out, and heating up Alaska for us. That's a bad thing.
But 10 to 15% of the cost goes towards state-mandated safety improvements, like installing smoke alarms and ventilation systems.
Some folks don't realize it, but water, moisture from your breath, from your cooking, from your aquariums, from your plants, can cause negative effects on your home if you don't properly ventilate.
Simpson says sealing up duct systems can also prevent contaminated air from being pulled into the house. One of those systems was installed in Lozano's trailer. She enthusiastically points to a label in the bathroom, which reads, Whole Building Ventilation Control.
This is the first time that I have in my house.
A few moments later, a fan controlled by a sensor automatically turns on, pulling moisture and contaminants out of the air.
I really like it.
Lozano has lived in her three-bedroom home since 2009. She says it used to be filled with dust and cobwebs.
You see, if you move this...
She bangs a roll of toilet paper down on the counter.
Should be have a dust burst out, but there's no. There's no dust. That's the reason that I really like. I really believe that this is work.
As her new furnace flips on, Lozano says she loves the program.
It's not leaking. Can you see here? It's warm. And also, there is no cobweb.
Warm air gushes up from the vents, and Lozano settles into her chair at her kitchen table. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Warmer than normal temperatures this fall are allowing expanded use of salt to combat icy roads in Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, salt is more effective in some conditions and less expensive.
The State Department of Transportation began testing the application of a saltwater mix on Fairbanks roads 3 years ago. DOT Fairbanks Maintenance Superintendent Dan Schocker says the brine mixture is only effective on pavement that's 15 degrees Fahrenheit or warmer.
And we have had that, you know, numerous times here recently, so we keep putting forth an effort to use it where we can.
The state has two trucks set up to spray brine on roads, and they're focused on hills, curves, bridges, and intersections. Schocker says brine was especially effective early last week when rising temperatures resulted in a dangerous coating of frost on pavement.
We could have put down abrasives, and they'd have been gone with the first two or three cars. There's nothing there to hold it. So we had the opportunity to use this. We had several calls from the troopers with accidents already, and as soon as we started putting this stuff down, those calls all went away.
Schocker additionally praises brine for being less expensive than sand and gravel, plus cheaper maintenance-wise.
This is something we don't have to clean up later. It basically evaporates and it's gone.
The 23% salt solution being applied to roads also includes an organic compound. Schocker says it helps salt stick to pavement and combats corrosion. Local auto mechanic Steve Levy ties the application of salt to roads with an increase in corrosion-related vehicle problems.
This year and last year is when we're starting to see the impact of salt damage on cars in the repair process. When we need to take apart a hub assembly or replace a wheel bearing on a car, we're having to cut bolts and then cut out bushings and replace bushings, which, you know, doubles and triples the cost of repairs.
Levy recommends washing vehicles often to remove salt.
You got to get underneath the car and you've got to get around the wheels on the inside of the wheels. That's where most of the expense is going, is in the strut areas, in the hub area on the inside, brake parts. I don't know how much you can do about the exhaust parts, but the more fresh water you get to rinse things down, the better.
The state Schocker contests how big an issue road salt is for vehicles in Fairbanks because of its very limited use here. He says about 30,000 gallons of brine have been spread on local roads this fall, a fraction of the hundreds of thousands of gallons used monthly in some lower 48 cities. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Ocean Observing System is celebrating its 10th anniversary of aggregating information about ocean conditions and sharing that data with a wide range of partner organizations and other ocean users. Molly McCammon is the executive director of AOS, a former director of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council. She was asked to head up a new ocean observing organization in 2003. McCammon says Congress wanted a better system to integrate ocean research, and in 2004, AOS was launched. She says traditional research looks at what needs to be learned, but AOS starts with who the users are and what they need to know to make decisions.
in Alaska, you can't do anything without partners. So the Alaska Ocean Observing System is not one entity. We are made up of all of our partners. So we are in partnership with the Marine Exchange. We are in partnership with the Coast Guard. We're in partnership with the National Weather Service. We work really closely together. And some people say we're the kind of the seed, the instigator of various activities. Others refer to us as the glue for various activities that pull together all of the partners. But I think the end result is that we can look across all the various entities. We can work with the private sector. So we have no problems working with Shell or with World Wildlife Fund. We can go to a federal agency. We can go to a state agency. We can pull together bits and pieces from all these entities, work collaboratively with them, and help decide what kind of product do we need for the user community.
In the past decade that you've been providing this service, have there been surprises in the findings that you're collecting?
When we started 10 years ago, ocean acidification was not an issue. It was not on our radar at all. Certainly, the melting of sea ice has accelerated much more quickly than anyone anticipated. In my lifetime, I will likely see an ice-free Arctic. I would never have said this 10 years ago. So the emphasis on the Arctic and the changes there and what could happen with diminished sea ice, this has now become a global issue. It's now getting more national attention. And certainly for us in Alaska, it's a huge issue.
What do you think the next 10 years will look like for the work you're doing? Will the focus change going forward?
I think what's changed the most and what may change the most in the next 10 years is changing technology. We now have a number of tools that are being developed that we have better ocean observing instruments. We have gliders. We have drones. And I should emphasize, too, here that Alaska is... We have huge challenges here just because we are so remote. We have the extreme weather and also 44,000 miles of coastline. That is a tremendous area and, you know, huge oceans with the Gulf of Alaska, the Bering Sea, the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. We have huge area to observe. But I think changing technology will help us with that.
Molly McCammon is the executive director of the Alaska Ocean Observing System. AOS is celebrating their 10th anniversary with a celebration and film festival at the Anchorage Museum tonight, starting at 6:30. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Zachariah Hughes, Ellen Lockyer, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Alaska Native elders are 5 times more likely to be injured in a fall, but there are simple ways for elders to reduce fall-related injuries. Get an eye exam every year. Stay informed about medications that can cause dizziness. Exercise regularly to increase strength and balance, and keep your home clutter-free. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.